Let me help you to
piss off, damn. You're one of them. This is just another torture session. You're trying to play with my mind. Piss off or I will blow you to hell. Rack off, rack off, rack off, rack off, rack off, rack off, rack off.
My shot took out the reactor control system. The reactor, as it had been designed to do, executed a graceful shutdown, and Henry, as the replicant hardware had been designed to do, went to sleep. This wasn't what I'd signed up for, but I wasn't going to leave the guy like this. Epsilon Indy had a Jovian planet a bit outside of the habitable zone, and not much else. I promised myself I'd have a more thorough look around as soon as possible, but first I had to take care of Henry. The system didn't have an overabundance of ore, but fortunately Henry had located the biggest concentrations. I started the auto factory on a space station right away. I wanted to talk to Bill about this, but a conversation with a 14-year latency would take forever. I was playing with the idea of flying back to Epsilon Eridani and taking Henry with me. I did a close-up investigation of the Australian hardware. It was very similar to my own. No, I mean, really similar. There had obviously been some espionage going on, and someone had borrowed someone else's design. No way this was coincidence. I carefully extracted the replicant core from the palace. I set the auto factory to building a proper cradle, power supply, and extra memory. Once I was sure that I had Henry out and safe, I began breaking down the palace for material. I felt a little guilty, like I was stealing or something, but Henry really wasn't using all this, and it saved time. Henry didn't have the knowledge to put together VR, but I did. I could piggyback him on my system, and he might still be salvageable. I stood for a moment behind Henry and breathed the brisk, salty air. The Contessa cut through the chop with a bounce and roll that I found alarming, but that Henry had reassured me was normal. He had known his vessel down to the last bolt and screw when he was alive, so it had been simple to reconstruct in VR. The South Pacific stretched out to the horizon in all directions. A steady wind to the northwest promised an easy, undemanding day of sailing. Or so the books all said. I was still figuring it out. Henry turned from the wheel to face me. "Hello, Linus. Come for another round of butting into my life?" I grinned at him in response. Henry was lucid nowadays, but believed himself to be back on Earth. His memories of the years as a replicant still came back to him as nightmares. I'd made his VR as realistic as possible, which included eating, sleeping, and, bodily functions.
"I had that dream again, Linus." Henry shuddered a little. "The nightmare where I couldn't feel myself, where all around me things talked at me and demanded my attention, wanting me to build something, where the world was just an endless scroll of night."
I sat down. "But it's getting weaker, right? Less intense?" Henry nodded. "Good. Now, tell me about when the government came to you to offer you the chance to be the space probe replicant."
41. Riker, May 2162, Sol. Homer and I looked at each other in amazement, then back at the message. Plans for a subspace communications universal transceiver, SCUT, with zero latency. Homer shook his head in disbelief and admiration.
"Some bitch, he did it."
I nodded at him, sharing the emotion. I think this qualifies as a good reason to interrupt the printer schedule. We examined the finished product. It was obviously not built with marketing in mind, not a trace of chrome, no logo, but according to the notes, communications should be instantaneous across interstellar distances. Almost shaking with excitement, I turned it on.
"Connections available. Epsilon Eridani, Omicron Squared Eridani."
I examined the menus, registered myself with the software, then pinged Bill. Bill's video image popped up immediately.
"Hey, Riker. Long time."
"No kidding. 17 years from Bill's point of view, less for me thanks to Einstein." I sat back, arms crossed, and looked over at Homer's video window. He was grinning from ear to ear. Bill waved at Homer.
"Dude, I see you're still in one piece. And I see you no longer use the cartoon avatar. Any causal connection?"
Homer threw his head back and laughed.
"Yeah, pretty sure. Number two is actually talking to me these days. I must be slipping.
I gave him the Spock eyebrow. Yeah, but I don't need you now.
Homer looked shocked, and Bill grinned at both of us.
Well, it's nice to see some things haven't changed, Bill said. And now that we've gotten the reunion warm and fuzzies out of the way, I've got a bunch of software updates and VR improvements, as well as some hardware upgrades I can download to you.
Anything that implements an ignore list? I glared at Homer.
Bill looked from me to Homer, grinning at both of us. Now, the big question. What's the situation with Earth?
I pulled up my logs. Here, I'll send this to you, faster than explaining it. The setup allows all normal VR interfacing, right?
Yep, this is just a different transport layer. Same object interface.
I nodded and pushed the files toward him. Bill did a momentary frame jack as he absorbed the information, then came back with a wide smile.
That is so cool! Then he lost the smile.
Not the part where 99.9% of the human race is dead, the survivors part.
And the relatives part, of course.
I nodded. It's okay, Bill. We've all had the same foot and the same mouth, so listen. Have you got anything back from other Bobs on possible new homes?
I guess I've got a file for you.
Twin planets?
Colonel Butterworth's eyes were wide.
Yeah, just like the file says. I knew I was grinning like an idiot. I couldn't stop. After the years of worrying, this was such a huge relief.
The colonel looked at me with one eyebrow cocked.
I doubt you'll give us both planets. I expect we get first choice and the Spitz get the other. That about right?
I looked at him in surprise. He had to be testing me. He couldn't possibly be that dense.
Colonel, we won't be giving an entire planet to 20,000 people. We could put all 15 million on one of them, in theory. If any traveling Bobs find more planets, we'll expand the choice of destinations. But at the moment, everyone is slated for Romulus or Vulcan.
The colonel gave a small smile.
Yep, testing me.
As you say. Although I might suggest that some rebalancing of populations would be in order if more worlds are found.
I nodded. We'll play it by ear, Colonel. There are still too many unknowns to make any hard and fast plans, but at least we have a destination.
True. That means no delay once the ships are ready.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to make a general announcement to the community. I guess you'll want to be there.
The Colonel smiled.
I'm also delighted that we no longer face the specter of living under domes on Epsilon Eridani II. I'm not sure if I'd see the point of going at all, unless things got far worse here.
Colonization of Ragnarok had been a topic of conversation off and on since we'd first started the emigration plans. The general consensus was that it was a last-ditch option. I agreed with the colonel. It was nice to be able to set that option aside.
The news was met with joy, enthusiasm, and surprise, surprise, loud complaints. I guess I should have expected it, and if I hadn't been personally so giddy with the news, I would have seen it coming. No one wanted to share a planet. From the biggest city to the smallest enclave, they all wanted one to themselves. Colonel Butterworth and I looked at each other, and I could tell that he'd expected this. I let it go on for a while longer, then I asked for the floor.
Okay, okay. Look, here's the thing. Right now we have two planets available. That's it.
Sorry. We can't delay emigration until we get more because the Earth is becoming uninhabitable. So here's how it's going to go. When we're ready to ship a group, if there's nothing else available, they'll go to Vulcan or Romulus. If and when a new planet comes available, groups will get right of first refusal in the order in which they emigrated.
And meanwhile, they'll have settled in,
Walter yelled into the camera.
Yeah, and given the warm, welcoming feeling you're projecting, I've no doubt they'll want to stay put.
I held a moment of silence for effect.
Look, this isn't ideal, but this is a survival situation. We're abandoning a sinking ship, and we're spending too much time arguing about who is going to end up in what lifeboat with whom. Let's think about surviving first, okay?
As if it matters to you, you have no skin in this game, or at all.
That was Ambassador Gerald, the delegate from New Zealand, a former Aussie. For whatever reason, he had never liked dealing with me.
I was mystified by his animosity, as there didn't seem to be any reason for an attitude, pro or con. This time I simply smiled at him. I can leave any time. Just put it to a vote and vote me gone. I'll respect the decision, pick up my football, and go home. I looked around the videos. No? Then let's get back to realistic discussions. Without so much as a heartbeat of hesitation, the argument re-erupted. 42. Bill, April 2162, Epsilon Eridani. The update from Riker and Homer had been interesting on so many levels. The Svalbard seed vault was a pleasant surprise and could be a real boon for terraforming Ragnarok. There were a couple of varieties of plants and moss that conceivably could be made to grow on the as-yet bare soil, and if they took hold, they could accelerate the oxygenation of the atmosphere by millennia. Riker had promised to put a clone together to ferry some seeds out to me. But the most exciting item was a variant of a surge drive that could be used on large bodies, like asteroids or Kuiper objects. Epsilon Eridani 2 needed about 500 or 600 cubic kilometers of ice dropped on it in order to connect the seas into oceans. I'd been mulling over how to get those Kuiper objects into the inner system. Home and orbits would take decades to centuries. That wasn't necessarily a problem for me, but for humans needing a place to live, a little more alacrity might be in order. Anyway, the planetary body surge drive wasn't complicated, although it did require a lot of construction material. It occurred to me that I could use it to accelerate a chunk of ice into an orbit heading for Ragnarok, then remove the drive and fly it to another chunk. Rinse, repeat. As long as I had the drive available when flying icebergs started showing up at the tail end, I'd be golden. I discussed the idea with Garfield. He looked skeptical.
I understand the mechanics, Bill, but you'd better make sure that nothing goes wrong. You're leaving yourself no wiggle room for adjustments.
I shrugged. Well, if I fail to catch one of the chunks on the back end, it'll just sail past Ragnarok and probably end up in the sun.
If you fail to catch one, you'll probably be failing to catch a lot of them. Why don't you do a couple of simulations?
I don't think that's necessary, Garfield. Why are you going on about this anyway?
Look, Bill, you really have to stop treating me like Igor. I can do the math, too. Maybe you should take the time.
Igor? I looked at Garfield in shock. Had I been patronizing him? I understood the reference and the emotional undertone behind it. Something was definitely up. What's going on, Igor? I mean, Garfield. I grinned at him to show I was kidding. He returned a brief smile, acknowledging the joke.
I know Bob One made that rule about the senior Bob being in charge, but I'm getting tired of being a sidekick. We get a lot of stuff done here, and I'd hate to have to leave, but I think our working relationship needs some adjustment.
I nodded, thoughtful. I know you've been pestering me about some projects that you wanted added to our backlog. Is that what this is about?
Partly. Also more input on the stuff we are working on. Original Bob was a bit of a lone wolf, and you tend to work the same way, expecting me to tag along. That's not working so well for me.
I prodded my psyche. No surprise, I was offended. But I definitely didn't want Garfield to leave. We worked well together and accomplished a lot more than each of us could individually. Time to suck it up.
Okay, Gar, point taken. But don't expect a raise.
He laughed and waved a hand at the schematic, which had been hanging in the air, forgotten.
Good. Now, have a look at the plan and do the math. Take the time and consider the downside if you're wrong.
I nodded in thought. One of the important details of the project was that the ice chunks couldn't be allowed to slam into Ragnarok at interplanetary speeds. They'd have to be inserted into an orbit around the planet and broken up. The ice would come down as increased rainfall for a few weeks. I did the simulations as Garfield suggested. Turned out that having two of the drives would allow me to get all the ice to Ragnarok within 25 years. Now there was a plan I could get behind.
Garfield caught the softball, barely, and after due consideration, more or less whiffed it back to me. I cringed a little watching him.
Original Bob had never been much for sports, and even in VR we hadn't improved on the basic model.
You know what you throw like? I said with a smile. Yeah, like you. Tell me again why we're doing this.
First, it's a good test scenario for fine-tuning the VR. Homer commented at one point that some of the physics is still a little off.
I bobbed the ball in my hand a few times. Second, and more importantly, I think we have to do more than just sit in libraries and parks and command decks if we want to really retain our feeling of being human. I don't want to be reduced to some Dr. Evil cliche. I tossed the ball. This is an exercise in the physical sense, but it does remind our brains what it's like to do things. The return toss went way over my head and landed in the lake with a splash. Oops, Garfield said with a grin. I gave him my best glare and materialized another ball. I might build a bunch of bobs and field a team or two.
Oh, geez, no. Half of them will turn Canadian and want to play hockey instead, eh?
I laughed and tossed the new ball. 43. Riker. September 2164, Sol. The two colony ships were impressive, even in their half-built state. They would feature two drive rings and a massive reactor cooling section, all necessary to move the huge central cargo section. Since the cargo would be 10,000 human beings in stasis, a significant proportion of the mass of the vessel consisted of shielding. Overall, the colony ship would have looked like a military vessel to a science fiction fan of my day, but without the phaser banks or frag cannons, of course. One of the ships was farther along than the other. The concession to the Spitz resulted in some shifting of manufacturing capability. The third ship would be ready only 4 months after the first two. Now we were trying to even out the construction of one and two so that they would be ready together. I snorted with amusement, thinking of the last couple of UN sessions. Now that the yelling was over, this was more like a project from my former life. Technical challenges and engineering issues. With the manufacturing AMIs doing all the work, I didn't even have to worry about labor issues. Negotiations still continued, of course, back on Earth. No one was willing to quietly go along with being scheduled somewhere down the road. We still had the 1500 trip issue to deal with. We didn't know for sure that it would be a death sentence, but there was general agreement that the climate on Earth was getting worse. If it got bad enough, starvation was a real possibility, despite all our efforts. Homer and his crew continued to scour the system. They'd also implemented some techniques for bringing metal up from planetside. That was slow and laborious, especially given the scale of our requirements. I'd allocated a half dozen printers to Homer. Colonel Butterworth predictably had screamed like a stuck pig, with instructions to bootstrap themselves up to a viable operation. So far, Homer was doing better than expected. The amount of refined metal on Earth was considerable, even after the war and subsequent bombardment. He'd already returned the printers to regular ship production after printing up new ones. Homer had calculated the possibilities and gone into his good news, bad news comedy routine. The good news was that we could eventually build a lot more colony ships from what he estimated we could haul up from Earth. The bad news was that everyone would be long since dead. You would think the 3D printers would have solved the scarcity problem. In fact, the technology had just moved the bottleneck. We could build more drones to extract and haul the metal out of Earth's gravity well, or we could build colony ships, or we could build more printers in order to produce more drones and colony ships, during which time we would be producing neither. The calculations to determine the optimum path were finicky and had large error bars. Even thinking about them made me grit my teeth. The drone had reached its destination. I ordered it to establish a sideways vector, then watched the video as the colony ship's exterior drifted by. Unfinished sections allowed drones and construction roamers access to the interior. A steady stream of laden drones entering the hull was matched by a stream of empty clawed drones exiting. The status window revealed no current issues. The printers were keeping up with parts demand, Homer's supply crew was keeping up with raw materials demand, and the construction crew was kept busy 24/7. I shook my head and closed the video windows. Inspection done. Homer and Charles were in Earth orbit taking a break from their outer system patrols. We took advantage of the rare opportunity to have an all-Bobs meeting. Even without commentary from Arthur, the tone was a little gloomy. The climate of the planet continued to deteriorate and was possibly accelerating.
I think it's a given that we won't be getting 15 million people out system, Homer said, which means we have to come up with some way to keep them alive here.
Triaging will help. Charles poked a finger at his copy of the holographic globe. Emigrate the most marginal groups first, move everyone else to the most equatorial locations. I shook my head. Most of the equatorial locations aren't habitable. Not because of climate, some of them are actually more temperate now, but because of a lack of infrastructure. Conventional bombings or falling rocks will make a city uninhabitable. Add in the problem of a lack of power and water, and you can't just drop a bunch of people off in the jungle and expect them to survive. A lot of the jungle isn't jungle anymore, Arthur retorted. I grimaced in response. I know, Arthur, but it doesn't change the basic point. We can't move that many people to anywhere that doesn't have infrastructure, no matter how comfortable the climate. And I don't see the point of building temporary infrastructure when it's going to delay shipbuilding. And Butterworth will have a cow, Charles smiled ruefully.
Okay, Homer interjected. Spitballing, then. How about using space mirrors to warm up the Earth?
I looked at him in surprise. Not a bad idea, in principle. A lot of unknowns, though, as it would be all new engineering. I think we'd need a minimum of 1,000 kilometers radius for a mirror to have any appreciable effect. Plus, it wouldn't do anything to clear the spreading radioactivity or repair the damaged and destroyed ecosystems, at least not within a human lifetime.
And Butterworth, Charles said, smiling.
We'll have a cow, we all replied in chorus. Colonel Butterworth had become a bit of a cliché with his standard reaction to any change in plan. Homer shrugged. He'd done the math, too.
Let's pass it by the colonel and see if he grabs his chest and falls over.
Space stations? Charles ventured. Same problem, though, I guess, or moon colonies. Building all the structure and infrastructure to keep people alive in space would set the colony ships back decades, and you have to build for a population density sufficient to make a dent in the 15 million or it's pointless. I nodded, glum. I'd had all these thoughts. Not really surprising that the other Bobs had, too, but anything that we tried would detract from the shipbuilding. Any useful plan would need to either have negligible impact on the overall plan or would have to produce significant enough results in a short enough time to be worthwhile.
And the worst part, Arthur said, is that even if we stick to the plan as is, we probably can't save everyone.
I ran my hand through my hair. We keep coming back to this. Nothing we can think of actually improves the overall prospects. I guess all we can do is keep on keeping on and hope we stay ahead of it. I looked around at the others. No one would meet my eyes. 44. Bob, January 2166, Delta Eridani. I grinned. A black, featureless block. Dimensions 1x4x9. I leered at Marvin. He covered his face and shook his head vehemently. The strains of Also Sprach Zarathustra in the background, I continued. Marvin started to moan. As the Deltans leap about, one throws a bone into the air. Marvin dropped his hands and his eyes rolled. I waited a few more seconds for effect, then relented. So we'll just go with the drone, then. Marvin pinched the bridge of his nose. I can't believe I'm related to you. I laughed and turned to the desk. On a more realistic note, we have drones with speakers now, so we can talk to the Deltans. Honestly, I think I'll just go straight to Archimedes rather than trying to contact an elder. Oh, I agree with that. Any of the others would probably just run screeching from the area. Archimedes will be curious. I nodded. So, no background music?
Oi!
The surveillance drone showed Archimedes doing his usual patrol of the area. He varied his search from day to day and had taken to randomly digging holes, looking for more flint. A couple of the other juveniles had accompanied him on occasion, but without any payoff, that had soon petered out. I positioned one of the drones in a tree along his usual route. The drone camouflaged itself so that it looked like part of the tree trunk. Even if Archimedes spotted it, he wouldn't think of it as anything but wood. The Deltan language was far more guttural than anything humans could produce. I had set up a translation routine so I could converse in English without worrying about the fine details. Archimedes. Archimedes jerked and then went into a defensive crouch, looking wildly about. Don't be afraid. I want to help you and your people.
Archimedes slowly straightened up but continued to search for the source of the voice.
Who are you? Where are you?
I'm farther away than you can see, Archimedes, and I'm the one who destroyed the gorilloid that was attacking you. I'm also the one who brought the flint.
Archimedes' eyes lit up. Flint was priceless. I now had his complete attention.
What do you want?
I thought of all the ways I could answer that and decided to keep it simple. I want your people to leave this place and go back to one of the old villages.
Archimedes' eyes went wide.
So, old Moses wasn't lying? There used to be other villages?
Yes, Archimedes. And some of them are better places to live than this one.
Some have flint?
Yes. And a better water supply, more food, and better defenses.
His eyes narrowed.
If that's so, why did we leave there? Wouldn't that have been the place to stay?
I turned and grinned at Marvin. Kid's no fool, he said.
It would have been, Archimedes, but your people weren't thinking of that at the time. Then it was too late, and they'd been driven out.
So, why tell me? Why not speak to the elders?
Would they listen to me?
Archimedes had been searching for the source of my voice as we talked. Triumph lit up his face when he spotted the odd section of trunk.
You are a tree?
No, that's just where I am right now. Would they listen?
He snorted.
Most of them are so stupid. They ask no questions. They have no answers. They just eat and sleep and hunt.
I spent a few more minutes discussing it with him. He finally agreed to go talk to the village elders, although he made me promise to show a sign of some kind if it became necessary. In response, I canceled the probe's camouflage and floated it over to him. How's this?
Archimedes went rigid and his eyes became huge, but he managed to not bolt.
That works.
I watched from a distance as Archimedes talked to his elders, who sat in a semicircle facing him. It didn't seem to be going well. Despite all his recent accomplishments and rise in status, Archimedes was still just a juvenile. Even some of the other juveniles had started to laugh and make jokes. Finally, I'd had enough. I activated the probe and flew it over to hover above his head. The laughter and commentary cut off like a switch had been thrown. Archimedes was no dummy. The sight of the whole village staring at a spot over his head had only one possible explanation. In an impressive display of natural showmanship, Archimedes didn't look up or directly acknowledge the probe. He simply crossed his arms and looked smug.
In the background, Marvin commented, "Some things just transcend culture."
"Or species," I responded.
The disintegrating gorilloid was still very fresh in everyone's mind, and the probe looked similar enough to the pieces of the Buster to convince the Deltans.
There was no backtalk after that. Archimedes explained to them what I'd told him. When he was done, Moses leaped to his feet and started yelling at everyone. It was pretty incoherent, but consisted mainly of variations on, "I told you so." Apparently, Moses' stories had been dismissed for years, and this was payback.
Eventually, Moses' rant ran down, and the elders turned back to Archimedes. One of them, I decided to call him Hoffa, asked Archimedes if the floating thing would protect them from the gorilloids. Archimedes looked up at the probe, finally acknowledging its existence.
"It calls itself the Bob."
He looked around the circle.
"It can help, but there are few of them, and they are destroyed with each gorilloid they kill. They will guide, and they will help, but we must fight our own battles."
Arnold, who had been standing outside the circle and listening, chimed in.
"We fight here or we fight somewhere else. The Bob is right. This place is too open to defend, and I like the idea of more axes and spears."
He waved his axe around by way of emphasis, narrowly missing a few bystanders. The argument went on for hours. Inevitably, some people wanted to stick with the status quo just because it was familiar. They fought the plan tooth and nail, even at one point suggesting that they send a party of Deltans to scout out the other location. Arnold dismissed that idea with a comment that he didn't want to come home to a camp full of corpses. I looked over at Marvin.
"Jeez, this crap is universal."
"Yep," he replied. "Politics is apparently politics through the whole universe." 45. Bill,
January 2165, Epsilon Eridani.
Incoming Scut communication from Alpha Centauri.
Cool! I put down the file I'd been working on. Calvin or Goku?
Bart.
I raised an eyebrow at Guppy and got exactly the same reaction as always. I sighed and grabbed the connection. Bill here. Hey, Bill, this is Bart. I'm from Calvin's first cohort. Wow, this is really... I popped into Bart's VR. It was a little rude doing that without an invitation, but I always got a kick out of the surprised look on my face. I liked Bart's VR right away. He'd set up a rustic log cabin with a cast-iron wood-burning stove, a fireplace, heavy handmade furniture, and lots of rugs and blankets. It reminded me of a place my father used to take us for vacations when I was a child. Bart was sitting in the big old rocking chair in which Dad used to spend most of his time relaxing. He had the look. I mentally added another notch to my scut cabinet. Holy! I laughed at his boggled expression. Welcome to Bobnet. Instant communications up to about 25 light years. So, Bart, what happened to Calvin and Goku? Bart took a moment to examine the VR quality before answering. They all did that. The guys reconnoitered Alpha Centauri A and B exactly as set out in the mission profile. They found a Brazilian factory in full swing in A, and the wreckage of a USE probe and auto factory in B. I guess we can consider the USE probe accounted for. Bart did a half shrug. They executed a sneak attack on the Brazilian installation. The modifications for the version 3 Heavens are really effective, by the way, and wiped it out. Excellent. Any colonizable planets? No. Bart shook his head slowly. The system is great for resources and such, but nothing livable. And not completely excellent, by the way. One of the Brazilian probes got away, although we don't think it was completed yet, so it may be unarmed. And it may not have the autofactory equipment loaded in. I thought for a second. Not great news. Medeiros may try to hijack someone else's installation, or maybe skulk around for a while and then raid you guys. We set up early warning systems, not to worry, and we scanned the system pretty thoroughly. I think he'll head elsewhere. I shrugged. It wasn't worth dwelling on. We couldn't track him at this point, so we just have to wait until he showed up somewhere else. Anyway, Bart continued, Calvin and Goku set up a Bob factory, then left as soon as one of us was ready to take over. I built the Scut when I received your transmission, and that brings us up to date. I accepted the folder that Bart pushed toward me and took a moment to scan it. Nothing earth-shattering. I was impressed, and a little smug, at how well the version 3 improvements had worked. Medeiros would have to significantly up his game if he wanted to compete now. I'm glad to see a Bob factory in operation, I said. I've been a little remiss in that department since I sent out the last group. I can feel less guilty now. Bart smiled in return. We spent a few minutes getting caught up, and Bart promised to pop by occasionally for a game of scrub baseball. With Bart and the other two Bobs currently being completed, we finally had enough to fill the positions all the way to the outfield. 46. Milo. August 2165, 82 Eridani. I decelerated smoothly into the 82 Eridani system. According to all the astronomical info, this was a very good candidate for a habitable planet. The star, a G5 V-class, was smaller and less luminous than Sol, but still well within the characteristics of yellow suns that human beings would prefer. I didn't want to get cocky, but I was anticipating having two good finds in a row under my belt. I doubted I'd ever get a chance to stamp a Brazilian silhouette on the side of my hull like Bob 1, but maybe a couple of planets with green check marks. Yeah, that's the ticket. I watched the survey results intently as the data slowly rolled in. Finally, Guppy announced pay dirt. Not one, but two planets inside the comfort zone, although one was at the inside edge and the other almost at the outside edge. Still, it was exciting stuff, and that would be four planets with check marks, thank you kindly. Impatient to pass on the good news, I aligned my comms array with Epsilon Eridani and began squirting telemetry back to Bill. I set a course toward the outer of the two planets, since it was closer. The planet had a large moon farther out and a smaller moon closer in. Strangely, the larger moon showed a blue color. I suspected that it might actually have open water.
The planet itself definitely had large bodies of water. As I decelerated to place myself in a planetary orbit, proximity alarms sounded. It took me a moment to focus on the cause. 4 missiles were coming around the curve of the moon, and they were accelerating aggressively. Crap! I turned tail and accelerated away, but it was obvious that they had far better legs. I did the calculations, examined alternatives, but there was no out. I was hooped unless I took out all 4 missiles. I took a moment to give my busters extra instructions to seek out a ship matching the Brazilian profile after dealing with the missiles, then launched all 8 busters in the usual pairing strategy. As the busters headed toward the attacking missiles, my proximity alarms blared again. 4 more missiles had appeared, coming around the opposite side of the moon. I was out of busters. With no chance of calling them back to me in time, I had to depend on my railgun. I did a quick computation. I'd likely get 2, possibly 3, but there just wasn't enough time to load the railgun fast enough to take them all out. Medeiros had outflanked me and done a good job of it. As I fired at the approaching missiles, I made sure the communications array was still lined up and squirted off a description of my situation and a differential backup. A calm part of my mind calculated that I wouldn't get it completed in time. Damn. The last 2 missiles filled my view.
47. Riker, January 2166, Sol.
They're dying, Colonel.
The Colonel wore his chin out expression, a sure sign that I was in for a fight. In the last year, Vehement had started attacking food production and supply facilities. Most of their attempts were no more than token efforts, statements, really. But the last 3 incidents had taken out supplies that the groups in question couldn't spare. Now they were out of or about to be out of food with half the winter still to go. Barring cannibalism, we were looking at hundreds of deaths before spring. Unfortunately, the current political climate was short on empathy. A couple of failed groups, to most of the others, just meant slightly less competition for the emigration queue. The USE encampment, the Faith Enclave, and the Spitz were the richest in terms of food reserves, but they had made it clear that they weren't about to volunteer anything to help out. The Spitz in particular were trying to stretch their resources out for as long as they could. Their annual surpluses were swiftly being whittled away. They would be a have-not within a few years. 3 hours of negotiating, pleading, and threatening had accomplished 0. They knew I wasn't about to abandon them, so they were willing to call all my bluffs. In disgust, I finally cut off the video connection without so much as an over and out. Homer looked at me from his video window. He'd been following the whole thing.
Damn, Number 2. This is kind of a rock and a hard place situation.
I nodded glumly. For the moment at least, I was out of ideas.
It's going to get worse, Homer added. The climate isn't improving. A lot of groups are only surviving because of reserves of some kind. They're not producing enough food to get by.
Thanks, Homer. I needed that encouragement. Homer shrugged. To be fair, he probably wasn't trying to bait me.
What we need, Riker, is to go into the farming business or something.
We've been over that, Homer. We actually could establish farms in the former tropics, but they'd be good for maybe 20 years maximum, and we'd have to build the infrastructure. All the existing farming infrastructure is in the formerly temperate zones. Homer stared into space, rubbing his chin.
I keep coming back to space stations. Something itching at me.
I opened my mouth to object, and Homer held up a hand to forestall me.
I know, Riker, too complex, not enough population density in a space station to make it worthwhile, too much risk. I just think we're looking at it wrong.
I gave a half shrug and started to respond when Homer yelled, "Crap!" and froze. I pictured Homer getting hit by a missile and had a moment of panic, but he came back right away.
Arthur's dead.
Homer looked as angry as Homer ever did.
I just got the telemetry from the drones up Saturn way. He was working some wreckage when there was a nuclear detonation. I'm getting reports from drones farther away from it.
Homer sighed.
Booby trap. No way to tell who set it up. I told him several times to watch for those. He got careless.
Did he save a backup anywhere? Even as I said it, I knew the answer. Making a backup and keeping it on board was easy, but pretty useless in a case like this. And we didn't have the space to save each other's backups. I had a to-do item to build some storage into the Sol space station for just this purpose, and like 99% of my to-dos, it was filed under someday. I took a moment to mourn for Arthur. Downer or not, he was one of us. Homer was looking at me expectantly, and I realized I was having trouble focusing. With an effort, I brought myself back on track. Okay, Homer, get the drones to recover what they can, and I'll go talk to the colonel. Looks like we're going to need to change the schedule again. We can't do without a fourth Bob, and I think we'd better build that storage matrix.
There's an alternative, Homer said. We've got the printers from my Earth scavenging ops. I wouldn't say they're exactly idle, but at least Colonel Butterworth isn't leaning over them and steaming them with his breath.
I laughed at the unexpected imagery, and Homer was right. I nodded an acknowledgement to him and forwarded to Bill an in memoriam entry about Arthur for the archives. As soon as Charles was back in Earth orbit, we would have a wake. 48. Bob, May 2166, Delta Eridani. It took almost a month to get ready. The trek to the best village site would be long and arduous. From discussion with Moses, it seemed that it was one of the first villages to be abandoned, and, unfortunately, it was the one with the best supply of flint. Moses wasn't clear on why it hadn't been better defended. He apparently had been a young cub at the time, and most of his information from that era was second-hand. He'd been one of the last Deltans to be trained to nap flint before they were forced to leave. In any case, Marvin had surveyed the route that they would have to take. It would not be easy or quick. A mountainous spine ran down the center of this continent, and there were only a couple of passes that were low enough to be useful. During that part of the trek, there would be no local food unless the tribe got very lucky. I didn't know if the Deltans had lost the techniques for food preservation or if they'd never developed them. Before they could leave, I had to teach them how to preserve meat. The Deltans understood the benefit right away and took to it with enthusiasm. The Deltans worked to build up a larder for the journey. Once the decision had been made, everyone got on board, and with the immediate gift of knowledge that I'd brought, they began to trust that I was steering them in a good direction. Gorilloids were spotted on a number of occasions hanging around the edge of the Deltan territory. They might have been hoping for targets of opportunity, but they seemed to have had the stuffing knocked out of them in our last encounter. They didn't challenge any of the Deltan hunting parties. Of course, the sight of an occasional drone floating about might have had a little something to do with that as well. I was quite happy to put the fear of Bob into them. While I waited for the Deltans to finish their preparations, Marvin and I made sure we built some more busters. They were hardly an ideal weapon, about equivalent to fishing with dynamite, but they were better than nothing. Besides, they made up for their lack of precision with an abundance of theatrics. We also faced a breeding issue. Deltans, it turned out, had an annual breeding cycle, and a large number of mothers-to-be were coming up on their due date. The Deltans were rightly reluctant to move before the latest generation arrived. Archimedes' stock continued to soar with the other juveniles. He was, for all intents and purposes, now a member of the tribal council, something that even Arnold couldn't claim. I also noted in passing that Archimedes was now showing a lot of signs of Deltan puberty. Likely the next few years would see a whole bunch of mini Archimedeses running around. That was fine with me. There was a noticeable difference between talking to him and talking to most of the rest of the tribe. Finally, the day came. The whole tribe lined up, packed their belongings onto several travois, another gift from the Bob, and set off into what was for them the great unknown. The gorilloids were in evidence on departure day, hanging around just out of range and watching the parade. I wondered if the gorilloids actually understood that their erstwhile prey was about to leave for good, or if they were just drooling over all that lunch on the hoof. Either way, the first gorilloid that made a move would get a buster in the face. I was lined up, ready, and just waiting for something to obliterate. The first night was a less-than-stellar experience for everyone. It rained heavily. I had to keep reminding myself that the Deltans were used to this, They didn't have tents, just sewn together skins that each family group would drape over itself. I resolved to introduce Archimedes to the concept of tent poles.
Better take it easy there, oh great one. Next thing you know, they'll be eating fast food and watching TV.
Marvin leaned back in his chair with his hands behind his head.
Seriously, it's not necessarily a good thing to throw too many new concepts at them at the same time. Floating metal deities seems to me to be more than enough for now.
Funny you should say that, I frowned in thought. Have you noticed they don't appear to have any concept of religion?
Marvin waved a hand in the air. There's some basic animism there in the form of things like honoring the animals they kill for food and venerating their dead. I doubt humans had much more at the hunter-gatherer stage. He sat forward abruptly. Hey, speaking of which, do you realize that we have the opportunity here to document their entire prehistory? Well, from the time we got here, anyway. Already started, Marv.
The camp seemed to have settled down for the night, so I deployed a couple of probes into guard positions and set up parameters to interrupt me. Security precautions complete, I swiveled to face Marvin. I notice you've started a batch of bobs at the auto factory. Not that I'm complaining, since that is part of our mission profile. I just wonder if you've changed your mind about hanging around.
He smiled at me. Not immediately. Although I do feel an itchy foot once in a while. Like I said to Luke and Bender, I'm curious as to how this is going to turn out. But it is still your show. Maybe there's another planet of sentience out there for me.
I nodded thoughtfully. How about the planetary survey? Any other Deltans anywhere?
Nope. This continent is the cradle of humanity for the Deltans. Strictly a local mutation. There are lots of related species, but none that use fire or make tools.
I pulled up a globe of Eden and checked out the detail that we had amassed. It gave me time to think. I realized that the idea of Marvin taking off was unpleasant. Somehow, I was a little less of a loner than original Bob. I dreaded the idea of being on my own again. I sat back and looked over at Marvin, who was tinkering with his own copy of the globe. I sighed and cleared my holotank. The Deltan migration was still pretty close to the schedule. There had been no major glitches so far, and the tribes seemed to have settled into routines. I was not so relaxed. We were now well out of the territory of the gorilloids whose butts we had whooped. Any gorilloid in this area would only see a bunch of easy pickings. Accordingly, Marvin and I had doubled the number of drones on guard duty at night. So it was more than a little irritating that the attack came during the day. As gorilloid raids went, it was not particularly impressive. A dozen or so of the animals hit a straggling family group and made off with two juveniles before anyone could react. The Deltans reacted immediately, giving chase and trying to cut the gorilloids off from the forest. In this situation, a buster would be as big a danger to the two juveniles as to the gorilloids, so we settled for buzzing the animals with the drones, trying to confuse and distract them. It seemed to do the trick. Within moments, the Deltans caught up and skewered half the gorilloids. The rest fled into the trees with screeches of alarm. Unfortunately, one of the juveniles was dead. The gorilloid that had been carrying him had apparently taken the time to ensure he wouldn't struggle or escape. The Deltans were distraught and had a burial ceremony that evening. But interestingly, there was no talk of the migration being a mistake. If this had been humans, I was pretty sure there would have been all kinds of second-guessing and recrimination. But the Deltans just took it in stride. I couldn't decide if they were being philosophical or fatalistic.
You know, that's going to happen a lot more as we go on, Marvin said to me.
The gorilloids? Yeah, I know. Not a lot we can do during the day, though. Infrared is useless. Everyone is moving at different speeds most of the time, and the area we have to cover is just too large.
Marvin sighed. I know. It's just that even with the last round of births, this is still a small gene pool.
I nodded and thought about the problem. Hey, didn't you mention at one point that there were small, isolated groups scattered about? Maybe we should try to amalgamate them.
Not a bad idea. Good for both groups. Tell you what, I'll send up a high-altitude survey every night to look for other fires. If we find any, we'll send in the Bob to convince them to move.
I grinned at him. My reputation as godling wasn't getting me a whole lot of local respect, even from myself. The migration had grown. Not only had we found several small groups and convinced them to link up, but apparently the parade was enough of a disturbance to be detectable for miles around. By the end of the first month, we had one or more groups join up almost every day. While there were often negotiation issues as different Deltans attempted to assert priority, those incidents generally ended without more than harsh words being exchanged. I had a feeling that the flint-tipped spears and Arnold with his big-assed axe contributed to that. Marvin and I tried to keep the drones out of sight, especially when there were noobs around. We didn't want to take a chance on scaring anyone off. Sooner or later, though, the topic would come up, or we'd have to fly in close for one reason or another. The results were usually pretty comical. Deltans didn't react any better to UFOs than humans would. The migration was up to well over 500 individuals. A very large portion of that consisted of females and juveniles. So Marvin and I heaved twin sighs of relief when the Deltans made it to the foot of the mountain pass. This part of the migration had its own dangers. The Deltans would be going well above the altitude of their preferred climate, so it would be colder than they were used to. They had no protection from either the weather or predators, and little or no available prey as they pushed forward. Before they started the climb, I made sure they re-inventoried their preserves. They would face a week or two without any other source of food. This was not the time to get sloppy. They started the climb first thing in the morning in order to get the maximum distance. I knew that they would slow down significantly through the days that the climb would take. They needed the best start possible. It took 4 days to get to the top of the pass. We'd budgeted for 6, so that was huge. The wind was god-awful there, though, so no one wanted to stop. They stretched that march well into the evening in order to get out of the wind tunnel at the apex. The trip down went faster, for obvious reasons. 3 days later, the migration streamed into forest again with some stored food left over. As a celebration, they camped for an extra day just at the edge of the forest. They took a break and feasted on the extra food. From here on in, they'd be able to forage and hunt. It took 2 more days for disaster to strike. 49. Riker, May 2166, Sol.
Firewall has blocked breach attempt.
I stiffened and turned to Guppy, the UN meeting forgotten. What? Someone's trying to hack us?
Affirmative. Source appears to be the video feed from the UN meeting.
Ongoing danger? By way of reply, Guppy threw up a stack trace. I examined the listings. It appeared that the hacker was basing his attack on the basic Heaven design. The original Heaven vessels had no firewalling, relying instead on all communications being encrypted. However, it looked like the encryption routines had a back door. Someone had injected some packets, which had run right into Bob One's firewall. I made sure the UN communications system was logging all traffic. I would try the hack on Sandbox Bob later. There was little doubt in my mind that the attempt originated from the Faith Enclave, but I needed some kind of documentation before I made accusations. And there was the question of what could be done about it. It's not like there was a planetary police force to complain to. The UN meeting seemed to be all about routine matters today, so I decided to get an early start on the day's administrivia. The first item was a message from Homer. Just one phrase.
Space station.
Complete with exclamation mark. I couldn't see what he could add to the idea that would make it viable, but I would talk to him when I had a few moments. I glanced back at the video feed of the UN meeting, but still nothing noteworthy was happening. There was a message from Julia, fairly long, talking about family history. She seemed to have adopted me as a relative with no qualms. I was a little choked up about that, and I hoped she didn't send it just on Cranston's orders.
Source is New Zealand.
Guppy had traced the packets back to their originating stream. But New Zealand? That made no sense. It also meant that I wasn't going to have the proof I needed to really make Cranston's life difficult. Maybe I could bluff. Meanwhile, the hack attempt wasn't going to get anywhere, so I might as well just let the perp keep at it.
I did a test ping at Homer, and he indicated he was free to talk. I took a moment to feel awe at being able to talk to him halfway across the solar system without any delay. We no longer had to worry about light-speed lag. I popped into Homer's VR. Space station? Homer minimized the window he'd been looking at and turned to face me.
The answer to our problems, he said with a grin.
Not unless you have something new.
Just a new perspective, Homer replied. We've been thinking of space stations in terms of housing people. Of course that won't work. Gotta get the air right, the gravity right, extra shielding for radiation, extra armor for micrometeors, construction for living quarters, feed them, entertain them, yada, yada, yada. But the engineering is a lot easier if we don't try to house people.
Homer looked at me expectantly. Okay, Homer, I give up. We're going to raise cattle, or... My eyes went wide.
And the penny drops, he said, pointing his index finger at me. Farming. You just need enough spin to establish an up and down, so the structural strain you have to engineer for is reduced. The interior can just be one big cavern, and sunlight is available 24/7. Some equipment to make sure the air mix stays correct and the temps stay in range, and we're golden.
I thought about it. Plants take CO2 and produce oxygen. Any kid with a match can reverse that, but we need to produce calories in as dense a manner as possible. Got anything specific in mind? He gave me a thumbs up.
Damn right. Remember that library entry about gene-engineered kudzu? Improved nutritional content, simplified growth environment, human digestible,
and high sunlight requirements, and optimum temps in the 20 degrees Celsius range. Where are we going to find those conditions? Oh, wait, I grinned.
Yeah, and since we have access to the Svalbard vaults now, we can pick the cultivar that best matches the environment we end up with.
Homer hesitated and held up his index finger.
But kudzu needs a lot of water, so we'll have to constantly truck a supply up, unless we bring in some icebergs from Saturn,
using the asteroid movers. I was becoming enthusiastic about this idea as we worked through the details. Which we can also use to bring in regolith for soil. Fertilizer will have to come up, but that's small potatoes volume-wise, especially once the operation gets going.
And the best part, Homer finished, is that the work can be done with my printers, the same ones that are building Arthur's replacement right now.
Homer's last comment made me think of Colonel Butterworth, and I groaned. The Colonel very likely wouldn't be mollified by that line of reasoning. To him, any equipment that could do something else could also work on his colony ships. Butterworth is still going to have kittens. Homer bounced up out of his chair.
This will be fun. Can I watch?
Not only did Butterworth have kittens, but the UN Assembly went ballistic. Everyone except the groups that were facing starvation was beyond apoplectic and well into incoherence. I sat there, jaw-dropping, as people complained about criminal misuse, their words, of a resource that wasn't even part of the construction equation. Finally, I'd had enough. I signaled for the floor. Ladies and gentlemen, here's the thing. People are about to starve, and I mean within 6 months to a year. Those of you with reserves have refused to consider sharing, so that leaves it to me to fix things. This is a viable option, and it doesn't even affect the schedule. Yes, it affects future colony ships as we're using scavenged materials for space stations instead of colony ships. However, I'm willing to trade future colony ships against current lives. And by the way, some of you here will be depending on our kudzu gardens by the time your turn comes around, so let's not be too critical, okay? I turned off my mic, which was the video equivalent of sitting down, and watched as the speaker was inundated with requests to speak. Unbelievable! This crap is universal. I was going through my daily round of calls, and naturally one was Cranston. Outstanding. On the other hand, I did have this hacking thing to talk to him about. I rubbed my eyes, got myself a coffee, then activated the connection. Good afternoon, Minister. Anything in particular you wanted to talk to me about?
In fact, there is, Mr. Riker. Today's session, specifically. While we are not the richest enclave on the planet, we do have some surplus.
He nodded an acknowledgement,
as you've taken great pains to point out on several occasions.
and you've refused to give any of it up. Has something changed?
In a manner of speaking, since you have this kudzu idea, it seems to me that giving up some of our surplus would now be a temporary setback rather than a permanent crippling action.